I'm Nick Harvey Doyle, an Ngunnawan man from the Northern Tablelands of New South Wales. The Yarn podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, and Bunurong people. We'd like to acknowledge First Nations people as the first storytellers. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
From the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, this is The Yarn. I'm Thomas Phillips. Blind spots are easy to see in others. It's much harder to see our own. This discrepancy is called the blind spot bias, and psychologists believe almost all of us suffer from it. This week, we're bringing you three stories about blind spots and misunderstandings. Stories about biases clouding our judgment and making us blind to nuance. It's the second episode of Dark Matters, a series about the fundamental essence of life and how so much of it remains a mystery to us. These stories were produced in collaboration with all the best mentors for the Science Gallery's new show, Dark Matters. The exhibition is open now and includes a listening station where you can hear work from our students. First up, Norshin Lee reports on the double discrimination faced by bisexuals, who often feel misunderstood by both the straight and queer communities.
Bisexual greedy. Are you half gay and half straight? You're a traitor to the rainbow community. Oh, it's just a face. These are just a few of the ridiculous stereotypes that bisexual people have to deal with. The truth is, bisexual people face various forms of biphobia, including denial, exclusion, and a very specific issue, double discrimination, which means they get discriminated against both within and outside the LGBTQ+ community.
And in terms of broader society, yeah, there's been standard examples of biphobia. Unfortunately, though, at times, elements of gays and lesbians have not been supportive as well. I felt very frustrated by that at times because often the things that have been said against gays and lesbians, they're reflecting back at us in terms of denials. And yet this was a point in time where gay men and lesbians were still being told, oh, if you just got some therapy, you'd be heterosexual like everyone else, which denies their identity.
This is Sally Goldner, a bisexual and transgender activist who has worked for more than two decades to advocate for the rights of LGBTQ+ community in Victoria. She experienced such challenges since she embraced her bisexuality in the late 1990s. However, over two decades later, biphobia doesn't seem to be getting any better. According to the Bisexuality Report, 42% of bisexual people have faced discrimination or poor treatment within the LGBTQ+ community.
In more recent times, the postal survey for marriage equality was appalling. It was so, sort of small target. And Anna Brown, who is now the CEO of Equality Australia, who is not very well respected by many in the bi community, is on public record in front of a group of bi people saying, oh, we couldn't tell bi stories during the postal survey because it was too complicated. Now, who's we? Who made that decision for whom, for starters? And then what's complicated about it?
Given these circumstances, it is not surprising that some bi people choose to hide their true selves and switch their sexuality to avoid potential exclusion.
Biphobia does exist in those ways. Bi people, they hear some of those stupid remarks like, get off the fence, make up your mind. So if they might identify as heterosexual in their more conservative workplace, they might say they're gay or lesbian at a so-called LGBTIQA+ nightclub.
In such an environment, being bi is tougher in the traditional countries, where awareness of sexual minorities is still pretty lacking. Leslie Wong was born and raised in a conservative country in China. She identified herself as straight until she fell for a girl at the age of 21. Since then, new challenges have arisen.
Being bisexual in China is tough. So when it comes to dating, things can start off really good. You are vibing, having a good time. But as soon as you review your true sexual orientation, most people just shut you down. Do you think we're all cheaters, twice as likely to stray? People also ask me dumb questions like, so, do you have a boyfriend and a girlfriend at the same time? The worst is when some straight guys hear about my bisexuality and goes like, hey, if we date, can we have a threesome with your girlfriend?
Bi people often receive such derogatory comments, which greatly increase their likelihood of depression and distress, says the bisexuality reports. On top of the usual biphobia, there is a unique dilemma for bi people in China. Marriage.
My ex-girlfriend broke up with me, saying that you're gonna end up marrying a guy anyway. It's total nonsense. We have the right to choose whether or not to get married. This has nothing to do with sexual orientation.
Influenced by traditional beliefs, if a person has not get married by a certain age in China, they would face tremendous pressure from society as a whole. And that's why bisexual often left out of the dating game. They're believed to inevitably marry someone of the opposite sex, which often leads to rejection by the same gender.
That was Norshin Lee. Next, Laura Bishop investigates a newfound appreciation for Furbies. Back in the 90s, a paranoid misconception turned the robotic toy into a national security threat. More recently, its quirky charm has made the Furby an unexpected queer icon.
If you recognize this noise, it may provoke in you a sense of nostalgic joy or an unsettling discomfort. These are the cries of a 1998 edition of Furby, a zoomorphic electronic toy whose tribe left Furbyland in search of a creature they could bond with. Whilst they were initially met with companionship from their new planet, they were quickly pinned as untrustworthy and evil, so much so that the US National Security Agency banned the fluffy robots due to fears the creatures were spies. So, why the hysteria? What is it about Furby that puts us so on edge? To answer this question, I spoke to Dr. Megan Rose, a cultural sociologist who specializes in cyber pets, telepresence technologies, and cute media.
I think that it's an anxiety about the technology hidden in a children's toy that's really easy to access and not understanding how that technology works. And it's this gap between technological understandings of the future and what that future says about the now. And then this combined with the fact it looks innocent, that's what makes it quite insidious. And there was already a lot of anxiety about things like Tamagotchi or other kinds of autonomous friendship-like devices that people thought was going to change the way that children learned to socialise.
Hey, Furby!
Do?
Tell me a joke.
Knock, knock.
Hey, Furby!
What?
Sing me a song.
Me, no. Listen.
With new Furby,
not.
You never know what's going to happen.
It's been 24 years since the NSA banned the Furby, and whilst they may not have necessarily changed the way children of the late 90s socialised, the relationship between Furbies and millennials has become somewhat of a cultural phenomenon, particularly to queer communities. Dr. Megan Rose explains why this might be.
So when it comes to for queer people, I think Furby represents this amazing queer out of failure in many ways. You know, Furby is fabulous, it's fluffy, it's got a range of different clashing textures, it's rainbow, it's got a little bit of a, out there personality. And I think that for some people that, you know, resonates with the queer identity. But I do think what may have happened is that queer people, and I'm a queer hyper femme, see in Furby that rejection, the horror, the shock, and then they link that to their own experiences. So people see in cultural artifacts or objects their own struggles and identities, and they take this on as a mascot.
To get a better understanding of the Furby cult following, I spoke to Penny Johansson, an artist and tattooist who curated a Furby exhibition at Melbourne's Old Bar in September 2022. I asked Penny why she's so drawn to Furbies.
Let me just look at the Furby while I answer. I don't know, it's real, like, straight off the bat, it's something about their, like, stare, like their thousand-yard stare. They're just so precious looking. And I think they have such, like, a mysticism about them. like the first time I saw a long Furby on the internet. Like, I'd loved Furbies for a long time before then, and then as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh my god, that's the best thing I've ever seen. I need to make one. And I made one called Marshmallow, and it's got like an articulated spine in it, and it's really like comforting. And I sculpted the hands out of Sculpey, and then they're on joints, so they're movable. And that was my first one, and it just became like such a like a child or a treasure to me.
Another artist in Penny's exhibition was Bill Hutchinson, who also happens to be a tattooist. I wanted to know if Bill thought Furby was a queer icon.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I'm part of the queer community myself. I'm a bisexual or pansexual, take your pick, person. Kids that were born sort of 90s through to early 2000s tended to be, from my understanding, sort of in the cusp of that being something that's still ostracised but growing into not being in terms of being queer. It was sort of just opening up to, you know, childhood playground taunts and, you know, not wanting to open up to being accepted. So I guess picking this weird, creepy, unusual thing and having it as an icon of identity kind of seems to go hand in hand with that.
Whether you think Furby is creepy or cute, there is no denying that behind its cubic stare is much more than meets the eye. Furby is the ultimate underdog, a symbol of reclamation and power. Furby is a reminder that when life gets tough, you can always shrug and say,
That was Laura Bishop. Today's final story is about the blind spots of parents who can't relax control over their adult children, leading to all kinds of tensions. Guanggao Li begins this piece by asking friends what causes these intergenerational disputes in their families.
Tattoo.
Dirty words. Learning is everything.
They do not recommend me to go to live halls.
Smoking, drinking, and swearing.
You know, in my hometown, if your father hasn't died, you can't keep a moustache or the beard. My father always told something like that. When I shave my face, he would yell at me.
滚！你看你笑什么样？穿的吊儿郎当。真是不明白你到底怎么想的，你不觉得丢人吗？丢不起人。 没有你这样的孩子，还有没有点规矩啊？真是让人伤透了心。
This is one of the taboo. My parents don't want me to get ear holes to wear the earrings, and they don't want me to have the tattoos, but already done all of these things.
你说你这是怎么回事？为什么非要这样子？你今天必须给一个合理的解释。
How do you sound about these taboos?
I think it is necessary for every family to have some taboos.
Maybe they just hope that I can have a good life. You know, some rules is a very great thing for me.
It is understandable in a way because my parents, they have traveled, but they're not living outside for a while. You know, Chinese culture are influenced a lot by the Confucianism. So in Confucianism, we have a saying like 身体发肤受之父母. It's kind of like everything you got is given by your parents.
That's a really just a very nice experience from elders. They make so many things and they know what is bad, what is good, and it can help me to distinguish the right from wrong when I was just a child.
Most of the taboos are lessons that parents have learned from their life's experience, and they don't want these bad things to happen to their children again.
When I go outside, I feel they just control me, and they said this is love. So I prefer to love myself and try to make my parents understand me.
So you have a strong connection between you and your family. It's kind of like they control you. So that's the part I don't like it. Why is my body? Why I can't decisions for myself? I want to shave, I want to keep it, or I want to trim my hair. I'm a definitely individual, I'm not dependent. This is the things I hate about those kind of taboos.
What makes you think they can control you?
You know, it's a link between me and my family, my parents. You know, sometimes I will think, oh yes, these things my parents told me don't do that, and yes, and now maybe I see the same things that happen, the same condition that happened. I will say, oh yeah, my mom told me before. That's true. So I don't think it's a restriction. I think maybe it's a nice type to know in some hard situation you need to do what.
They just do not recommend me to go to, but they not restrict me to. You cannot go to. If you go, they will do something. I think this because since childhood, my parents' education has led me to accumulate over time. I also have produced this kind of thoughts.
One thing is my value, my previously adapted belief. Because when I was a child, I was always told, like, you need to honor your parents and you should, like, follow the rules in the family. Even though I already grown up, those kind of ideas always, you know, appeared in my head. And another point is all about the financial independence. Because now I still need my parents to pay tuition fee for me. I can't live without them. So they may just impose their thoughts on me, like what kind of things they want me to do. So I think from those two kind of points, they just control me in a way.
That was Guanggao Li. A massive thank you to mentors Mel Chun, Ollie Krusek, Dan Simo, and Sammy Shah for their help on these stories. The Yarn is from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. It's produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Our executive producer is Louisa Lim. I'm Thomas Phillips. See you next week.